Good afternoon, everyone. This November's COP26 has the potential to be the defining conference of our generation, with the capacity to reshape the world as we know it. With Donald Trump being forced off stage, it looks as if the world is once again ready to properly confront the existential threat of climate change. Joe Biden's election turned the tide, and he's shown he's serious by appointing John Kerry as his presidential envoy on the issue. China says it's serious too, so is the EU, as are many of the rest of the world's largest economies. So we really could be at a Rubicon crossing moment, where the concept of carbon net zero world starts moving from the abstract to the real. But that is obviously much easier said than done. Part of my homework in preparing for this session was to be reading Bill Gates' How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. At the end of chapter two, he sums up the task ahead as, quote, "We need to accomplish something gigantic we have never done before. To do it, we need breakthroughs in science and engineering. We need to build a consensus that doesn't exist, create public policies that would not happen otherwise," end quote. It doesn't take a genius to work out that that is going to have a profound impact on businesses and how they operate, with a slew of agreements, laws, and regulations raising many questions about how on earth we achieve it without causing another form of social, political, and economic disaster. To help answer the questions, we've got together a world-class panel. Alok Sharma is president of COP26. He'll explain how it works and the outcomes he's hoping for. John Pettigrew is the CEO of National Grid, a tier one sponsor of COP. He'll explain how his business is positioning itself in the fight against climate change. And Amber Rudd, very familiar on this call, is a Teneo senior advisor. As Secretary of State for Climate Change, she signed the Paris Accord. During the webinar, I'll also be calling on some of the senior figures in business to ask some questions. But before we get to that, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on the call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for anyone to broadcast or publish. Alok, I'm going to come to you first. Thanks for joining us. I know you're incredibly busy. You've been doing the role of COP president exclusively for the last few weeks. I want you to begin by just giving us a flavor of what's going to happen and what you're hoping for.
Great. Thank you very much, Greg. And thank you for inviting me on. It's great to be joined by my friends Amber and, of course, John as well. Look, you mentioned Bill Gates, so I had an opportunity last week to interview Bill about his book. And I think for anyone who has not had a chance to look at it or read it, I mean, it is pretty fascinating. And it's a positive read, actually. But one of the discussions we were having before we went live, so to speak, Craig, you were asking me where I was traveling. And I just want to tell you that the last visit I did was to Nepal. And one of the elements of the trip was actually going from Kathmandu to Jomsom, which is in the Hindu Kush Himalaya mountain range. By the way, for anyone who is claustrophobic, you probably don't want to take that plane, but it was great going there. And you see the magnificence of the Himalayas. You know, we passed 8,000 plus meter peaks. But at the same time, you saw the fragility of the mountain range and actually what climate change has done to it. So, you know, we got to see glacial lakes where the ice has melted. We were shown photographs of what that part of the mountain range looked like just 10 years ago. And it is pretty remarkable what has actually happened. And then when we landed in Jomsom, I had an opportunity to speak to some of the mountain community. And for them, this is really life and death. So they are faced with floods, they're faced with droughts, they're faced with landslides, and there are a range of communities who've literally had to migrate because where they live was no longer habitable. And I think it's when you see this, I mean, we see this on the news, we see this happening across the world, that no one is untouched by climate change. So, you know, Craig, what are we trying to achieve at COP26? What we're trying to achieve at COP26 is to deliver a positive outcome for those folks who are at the sharp end of having to deal with climate change. So I'm going around the world. Obviously, I've been doing this online for the last year, but of course now going around physically, talking to individual countries. And we are asking them to do four things. The first is that we want them to set out their targets for cutting emissions by 2030, ambitious targets, and as part of that, to set out a commitment to go to net zero by 2050 if they can. And 70%, by the way, now that the Americans are back in, 70% of world GDP is now covered by a net zero target. We're asking donor countries to step up and provide more finance to support developing countries. Amber will know that there was a figure of $100 billion a year commitment that was made by donor countries, and we need to make sure that we deliver on that. It's a real matter of trust, actually, for developing countries when you talk to them. We're very keen that countries come forward with their plans on how they're going to adapt to climate change. And then, of course, also how we close off elements of the agreement in Paris, the Paris rulebook. And I'm sure we can discuss that in more detail. But, I mean, where does business fit into all of this? Well, the great thing is that when I've been going on my visits, I'm also meeting businesses and society. And I genuinely think we are at an inflection point where governments, business, civil society are all saying the same thing, which is build back better, build back greener. And I think from a corporate point of view, it'd be great to hear what your members think, but I think it's been driven by three things. One is you've realized it's the right thing to do. Secondly, it's what your clients and customers want. But thirdly, it is also a driver of shareholder value. So there's a range of things that we're asking companies to do. One is to sign up to Race to Zero, committing to go to net zero by 2050 at the latest on science-based targets. And then, of course, if you are interested in displaying your wares, so to speak, at COP26, we have an expression of interest that is open until the 5th of March, and we want companies, we want academics, all of these people coming together to show what the UK is doing in terms of tackling climate change. And the final thing is that you know, John and his company, of course, are sponsoring COP26. We have other sponsors as well. So if that is something people are interested in, I'd be very happy to hear from you. And at the end of the day, to deliver meaningful change in Glasgow, we are going to need an all of society effort, and absolutely thank you.
Look, that's fascinating and really helpful setting it up, and a nice segue into John Pettigrew, who's the CEO of National Grid, who, as you said, is a tier one sponsor of COP. John, I wonder if you could just tell us why you are a tier one sponsor, what it involves, and what other advice you might give to other businesses who are interested in getting involved.
Yes, thank you, Craig, and thank you for the invitation today. I think it's just such an important topic, so I really appreciate the invitation. So I thought I'd say a few words actually just about why we feel COP is so important, as well as the reasons why we've taken the decision to become a sponsor. I think, as Alex said, I think there is no dispute that climate change is the defining challenge of our generation. And like many, it's our view that it's a critical time where, over the next few years, it's really important that we all play our part. From my perspective, I think COP26 provides a unique opportunity, partly to showcase, I think, the progress that the UK has made. And I'll come on to that, actually, because not starting from a base of nothing, actually, a lot of progress has been made since Paris in 2015. But also, I think it's an opportunity to show some of the actions that are going on today, but also how we can work together within the UK and globally, actually, to accelerate the progress that needs to be made. So National Grid, I think most people will know, we sit at the heart of the energy sector, both here in the UK and in the US. We recognised that we had a role to play, which is why we decided that we wanted to be a principal sponsor. And I believe it helps in a number of ways. First, as Alex said, it's just the right thing to do, and we want to show our support to the UK government in making sure that COP26 is a success. But also it allows us to demonstrate to our shareholders, our customers, to wider society that we are absolutely committed to supporting the energy transition. And people increasingly are seeing it as an important part of their investor proposition for businesses like National Grid. But in addition to that, it's a fantastic opportunity for us, actually, in terms of motivating and engaging our own people and future talent. You know, many people believe passionately in this agenda, so it gives us an opportunity to attract talent as we go forward. I think it's probably worth just putting, I think, the progress into context. So I think people quite often forget it, but since Paris in 2015, last year was the greenest year in the UK ever. The 53% of all the electricity produced in the UK came from zero carbon sources. Coal was only used for 1.6% of all the electricity that was produced. Back in 2015, that was 25%. And over the summer, you'll remember in the press, you would have seen the articles about we went over 2 months without using any coal, the first time since Victorian times. So There's been huge progress since 2015. And of course, with the ambition that Alok and the Prime Minister has set out with the 10-point plan and the Energy White Paper, we can reflect on really positive progress. But I think as we look forward, there is so much more that we can do. So from National Grid's perspective, we're looking to enable the implementation of the rollout of charging infrastructure for EVs. We've all seen the recent announcements from Jaguar and Ford about their ambitions, and therefore there's a need for infrastructure to support that. So we're trying to help in that area. We're looking for opportunities to create net zero carbon clusters. You know, there are 6 clusters in the UK that account for 44% of all the carbon emissions industrial sector in the UK. So if we can address that, we can make a material difference. And of course, we have a fantastic opportunity in the UK to really unlock the economic opportunity of offshore wind in the North Sea. For all that to happen, of course, we need to get the right policies to attract private investment. But one of the things that we're focusing on as we run up to COP26 is how we really engage with the general public and the country more broadly to make sure that everybody feels part of the transition and that we connect with the wider population and what it means for them. So for us, we think COP26 being a sponsor is the right thing to do. We think we've got an important role to play, but as Alok said, actually, it can only be achieved through collaboration between business, government, and broader sets of stakeholders. So I'll pause there, Craig.
John, thank you. That was great. Amber, so look, it feels like we're on the verge of something huge, but the implications of this are also huge. Do you think we really are at a Rubicon crossing moment?
Yes, I do. And I think that Alok put it well. Great to see you again, Alok. And so pleased you are the champion for this huge change that the UK is leading on. We are on an inflection point. And as John was saying as well, there's been such important changes since Paris only just over 5 years ago, that there is reasons for the sort of optimism that you will find in Bill Gates's book. 5.5 years ago, as people prepared for Paris, the whole Paris climate change talk felt like kind of a niche business, really. It didn't have the sort of huge well of support that we now have, not just in the UK, but internationally, to make sure that we got a deal. And when we all arrived in Paris, slightly wide-eyed, nearly 30,000 people, 190 countries, heads of state arriving at the beginning with all sorts of various challenges. UK diplomatic challenge, by the way, was to make sure that Prince Charles didn't have to cross with Mugabe, who was going to try and shake his hand. So with all those different challenges, it didn't feel necessarily obvious that we were going to get a deal, because the sort of the shadow of Copenhagen was still hanging over all the people who were trying to get a deal. But there were a number of things that were in place that allowed us to get a deal. The French leadership was pretty remarkable at pulling it together. The Americans were such an active player, and thank goodness they're back participating. And there was enough goodwill around, because there was businesses there, there were voluntary organisations there. There was a kind of coming together of enthusiasm that in the end we got a deal. But the overall watchword really then, and I think will be repeated this year, was compromise. There are so many competing issues going on here that everybody has to compromise a bit in order to get a final deal. And as long as everybody holds to that, I think that Alok and his team, and it's great that Andrew Griffith, who's the Prime Minister's net zero champion, is also on this call, will be able to get a deal. So much has changed in the past 5 years. Most of all, the goodwill, the momentum, the enthusiasm, the slight urgency, which has stepped up so significantly, but also the cost of tech. As John was saying, the cost of offshore wind, for instance, has come down. I think it's about a third of what it was 10 years ago. And solar has come down to a tenth of what it was 10 years ago. These extraordinary advances were hoped for, but not necessarily relied on. And now people know that they can see the path through. The question 5.5 years ago was, can we get everybody together to commit to reduce carbon emissions? The answer was yes, we could in the end. But the question now, which Alok and his team are leading on, is how soon can we do it and how can we help make it possible? And the answer to that is part of policy, which the UK has done so well in setting up, but not the only country, of course. Lots of other countries are doing it, and the EU has got some great plans as well. And it's also money, as Alok referred to. There is a commitment for 100 billion a year. The estimate is that we're about at 79 billion. So there's going to be a lot of pressure there. There's always a lot of pressure at these big international events from the less well-off countries who want help from the more well-off countries so that they can industrialize. It's not an unreasonable request, but it's another part of the complications. But given where we are compared to what we were, where we were 5.5 years ago, I think businesses are much more aware that they need to take action to commit to the net zero ambitions. And it's not just the right thing to do, as we've been saying, but it is their stakeholders who expect them to do it, their consumers, their shareholders. We've heard a lot about what's going on in the Green Finance Centre. There are more and more expectations that people do it. And as Alex said as well, it's about shareholder value. So I think we can be optimistic about this year, that businesses are going to need to make sure that they get ahead, I think, of the agreements that are becoming at the end of the year.
Thanks, Amber. That was great too. I'm going to start by putting a question to all of you, which is, like, we all get it. Something really does have to be done. Isn't there a danger too that we think it's straightforward? So I've read the Bill Gates book, and you're all right. It is full of optimism. But he also points out that it is beyond challenging, extremely painful, getting 51 billion tons of carbon out of the atmosphere every year. And I just wonder, in all this optimism and everybody carrying away, is there a danger of a backlash from society and businesses who say, look, you're crippling us, we just can't cope with this? So, Alec, let's start with you on that.
So, Craig, I think it's a very important point. And I think what you have to do is to demonstrate, actually, not just to business, because I think business do get it, and you could argue business is actually front-running some of this stuff because of the fall in the price of renewables that Amber talked about. I think this is also demonstrating to people around the country, around the world, why this matters for them. So we're not just doing this because we think this is the right thing to do. We're doing this because at the end of the day, not only do we get a better environment, but we also deliver high value added jobs at the same time. So John talked about the 10-point plan that the Prime Minister published last autumn, and then the energy white paper that we put out. And all of that is about demonstrating how do we as a government invest in sunrise industries? How do we then do this sort of issue of leveling up that the government has talked about a lot? And then how do we deliver those jobs in the areas that we need to level up? So if you look at the 10-point plan, it very clearly goes through what we want to do. And I think John made a really important point here, which is that, yes, you know, the government can put money, taxpayers' money, so the 10-point plan is about £12 billion there. But the key issue here is that how do you leverage the private sector money into this? We work with the assumption that we'll be able to leverage three times as much on the 10-point plan. And actually, take offshore wind, where Amber was saying, you know, the price has fallen by a threefold. Absolutely. And the reason is because we introduced a revenue mechanism for investors to be able to put money in and ensure that they got a return, the contracts, the different auction process. And that's what's driven up volumes, driven down price, and we now have the biggest offshore wind market in the world. I am optimistic that actually technology can help us drive this positive change forward at the same time, create jobs. And one other stat for you, which Amber will be familiar with, which is that, you know, over the last 30 years as a government, through successive governments, we have managed to grow our economy by 75%, so GDP up 75%, but emissions down by 43%. So actually, green growth is possible. We've shown, and others have shown, that it is possible.
Okay. John, help me out here. You're going to have a huge role in creating this kind of net zero future because of the nature of the business you run. You know, I'd love to buy an electric car, but I've got nowhere in my street to plug it in. That's just one issue, and that's going to cost tens of billions of pounds, presumably, just to restructure the UK for that. That's one thing. Help us understand how this is possible.
Yes, I think it's quite easy to sort of get overwhelmed by it and assume that everything we're trying to achieve by 2050 needs to happen tomorrow. And the reality is that we've got some huge challenges ahead of us, but we've got 30 years to sequence them. And I think the way that the UK has been approaching it is the right way. So, you know, we've focused very much over the last decade on decarbonisation of energy. And as Amber said, what we've seen is massive technology leaps. So, you know, back in 2015, I think offshore wind was £150 a megawatt hour on the CFD. It's now about 50. Solar prices have come down massively. So it's become more affordable as we've rolled out and decarbonized energy. So that was the right starting point for our agenda. The next step is transport. Transport is the biggest emitter of CO2. But what we've seen over the last 5 years is prices are starting to come down. As manufacturers are really investing in the capability, we're starting to see the unit cost of cars coming down. The challenge we now have is to make sure we've got the right infrastructure to support that on a charging basis. You'll see lots of naysayers in the press that will say that the grid can't cope and that if everybody plugs their car in at 5 p.m., we're going to have a blackout. But the reality is that's not how it's going to work. So first of all, it's worth just mentioning the networks in the UK are built to meet a half-hour peak demand once a year in the winter. The rest of the time, there is spare capacity. And through smart metering and technology, we'll be able to use that spare capacity to be able to facilitate the charging of cars and the growth in demand we're likely to see. Having said that, there is a need for infrastructure investment. You know, a lot of people won't have access to off-road parking, and therefore we need to have public charging. One of the things that we've been talking to the government about, and they've been very supportive, is creating a backbone of ultra-fast charging across the UK so that people are never more than 50 miles away from a charging point. And you can charge your car in the time it takes to get a cup of coffee from Costa's or Starbucks. That is, you know, from an engineering perspective, eminently achievable decade as we see the implementation of EVs roll out. You know, we've currently got 100,000 or so in the UK, and it's rapidly going to increase, and we can move with that over the next decade. It's challenging, but it is achievable. And then the final tranche is going to be all around decarbonisation of heat, which is probably the most challenging of all. So some of the things that we're looking at, like hydrogen, can you repurpose a gas network to use hydrogen? Can we see the cost of hydrogen coming down, whether it's using offshore wind or whether it's through taking the carbon out of natural gas? That is a big challenge for us as a country, because to achieve net zero, you have to address heat. And that is the thing that impacts individuals most. You know, 80% of people in the UK use natural gas for heating. And although we've done a really good job so far, most people haven't been affected by it, but their lives will be affected as we move forward with the electrification of transport.
Yeah. So, Amber, you were a politician before you joined us at Tenneo. You know what it's like trying to get elected and make promises to people, and who are often feeling a lot of pain on it. So part of my homework that I did before this as well was to talk to Andrew Cooper, who's a pollster for Populus. And he told me that actually we all say that everybody signed up to it, but that's not really true. It's the political class and the business class has signed up. And when you actually talk to ordinary voters, what they're worried is that Britain will lead the charge in this, pay a heavy price. And meanwhile, business countries like China and India won't pull their weight, and we will feel the pain and they will reap the benefit. What would you say to people who are thinking that, and the reality of people who are going to vote, who may be losing jobs in certain industries and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it is absolutely critical to any government to make sure that the policies they put in place are not going to lose them votes. And I would say that one of the things that we struggled with over the past few years in the UK was getting support for some of the policies when I would get MPs who will remain nameless coming up to me and saying, yes, but we are importing so much carbon from China, etc., which is why there is so much talk about a carbon border tax or some sort of form of carbon pricing. We know that there has got to be an evolved form of taxing carbon in some way. We have various ways of doing it in the UK. The EU, of course, has got the ETS, and the white paper talked about some sort of relationship with the ETS, but there will have to be some sort of agreement, and I would hazard that that's part of the discussions that are going on until November. And there is no way that the UK or any other country can do things which it doesn't bring the population with them on. But I think there is also a tipping point, as Alok said in his introductory remarks, that you don't want to be left out of this either, not a country and nor a business, because this is increasingly the way the public want to go. The polling may not reflect it yet, but I think the pollsters would agree it's going in this direction. And secondly, if you get there, you get the cheapest form of energy. You get the cheapest form of electricity. The prices have come down so significantly that in some parts of the world, it is now cheaper to have solar than in any other form of supply of electricity. So, and on the electric vehicles, Craig, you were saying if you were thinking about buying one, how do you charge it? Well, 5 years ago, that would have been a much bigger challenge, and not because just there were less electric chargers, but because the mileage reach of your potential car was nothing like where it's got to now, which again comes back to the industrial policy type argument that Alok was making. The more we invest in these products, the better they become. And an average Tesla now can do 350 miles, which means that it's just less need for those 50-mile stops all the time. So I would say that your point is good, but it's one that everyone's aware of, and it feels like it's going in the right direction. And there is a point, and we're nearly at it, where this is the right thing to do, not just because it's good for the planet, but because actually there are benefits in terms of cost, availability, accessibility.
Okay. Lots more to unpack. And as I said at the beginning, we've got people who've got questions that are pre-prepared that they want to put to the panel. Alan Knight, I think, is joining actually by phone, not in vision. So, Alan, just checking, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great. Alan, I think you've got question. Yeah. Yeah, you've got a question from Alec. And I should say that you're the head of corporate sustainability at ArcelorMittal.
Yeah, so ArcelorMittal is one of the largest emitters in the world, as one of the largest steel companies in the world. About 200 million tons. And we've been fascinated by, but there's an underlying two versions of this debate. Is it we eliminate carbon from the economy, which is why some of the steel companies are backing hydrogen, or can we carry on using hydrogen as carbon as long as we don't put it in the atmosphere? So CCF, CCU, replacing coal with biomass. So do you have any sense of where the debate's going to land? Is it all carbon is bad or all carbon emissions are bad?
Craig, I think you can say that one's for me. By the way, Craig, just to say that the reason that the 2030 date for stopping the sale of new diesel and petrol vehicles went down was accepted by sector is because there's £3 billion of public money that is going into the exact sort of things that you want, which is charging stations and the supply chain when it comes to gigafactories, etc. So go out there with confidence and buy your Tesla. Can I just come back on this point, Alan? You raised about taking carbon, eliminating it from the economy. Look, I mean there are certain sectors that obviously it is more difficult. In terms of decarbonizing. I mean, it's worth pointing out that actually, whilst we're quite positive about the sort of future direction, the mood music currently, it's worth pointing out that if we're going to meet the goals of Paris and the aims of Paris, we're going to have to decarbonize the global economy 5 times faster over the next 10 years than we've done over the past 20 years. So that's sort of quite a sobering thought. But in terms of decarbonizing industrial clusters, you will know that the government is investing in CCUS. And actually, I've just returned from India and had a meeting with a company called Dalmia Cement, which you may be familiar with. Cement, of course, is one of those sectors which is particularly difficult to abate. They have proposed that they're going to be carbon negative by 2040. And part of that is very much linked to the work that they're doing in terms of CCUS. So I think there is an opportunity in terms of decarbonizing industrial clusters around the UK using CCUS. And I think the intention is that we're going to be creating two of these carbon capture clusters by the mid-2020s. That's the current plan that we set out in the template plan.
Okay, Alan, I hope that's answered your question.
Yeah, very good.
I'm going to come down to Jaina Sparks, who's the head of strategic comms at Network Rail. Jaina, I think you can come up in vision, and let's just check that you are there. But I've got a question that I think we're probably going to try and get John to answer first, and then maybe Alec can throw in a line afterwards. But Jaina, go ahead.
Thanks. We obviously think that the railway has got a really big part to play in a low carbon future, and we're doing a lot to prepare for COP26. As always, our focus is first and foremost on providing great services for passengers, but we're also looking to bring state-of-the-art hydrogen and battery technology to the conference so that people can see these low carbon green trains of the future. So I guess in the spirit of that we should all practice what we preach, I'm really interested to hear what COP26 will be doing to encourage delegates to use sustainable and preferably public transport to get to the conference and to travel around in Scotland while they're there.
How are you getting there, John?
I'm definitely getting there by train. I wouldn't have thought of getting there any other way. So I don't know, to be honest, John, what's been discussed around COP26 in terms of day-to-day delegates. I mean, what I would say is I'm sure, you know, National Grid, like many companies, is thinking about its own impact on its day-to-day activities. So we've just recently published what we call our Responsible Business Charter. We're looking to electrify our fleet by 2030, but we're also looking to reduce by 50% the impact we have on other travel across the organisation over the next 5 years. So we're thinking very carefully about all the different activities we do and how we can mitigate the impact. And that will include what we do during the period up to and including COP26.
Oh, look, it's a big point, really, isn't it? That, you know, how people get there is just one of the things that people are going to be scrutinising about the conference. I mean, presumably you're aware that everybody's going to be going through everything you're doing with a tooth comb to make sure that it's all properly carbon neutral and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think sustainability is sort of the watchword in terms of the way that we're planning on organising COP. And by the way, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, obviously, there'll be a lot of people thinking, well, what sort of event are you going to have? And Amber talked about sort of 30,000 people at Paris. I mean, we are currently obviously planning for a, what I would describe as a sort of full fat conference at Glasgow. We'll look at the contingencies, but that's our sort of current plan. The key thing, of course, is that we keep delegates and also people in Glasgow safe. But as part of that, in terms of how people get around, obviously, we're going to make sure that we are going to be providing travel passes for delegates who come, so they'll get free access to public transport for the duration of the event. Hopefully, that means that people will not be driving or taking minivans or whatever they happen to take. So I think that is an important point for us. And then, of course, there is a electric train service that runs between Edinburgh and Glasgow, so there'll be opportunity for people to take that. And we're also looking at seeing how we can, as part of getting delegates around the various sites and events, is some form of a bespoke electric bus service. So that is something that we're looking at. Then, of course, as Amber said, you know, the leaders will come at some point during this summit. And of course, we are also going to ensure that the vehicles that they are taken around in are, of course, emissions free as well. So I think, you know, we're very conscious, Craig, as you say, that this has to be sustainable, actually, not just in terms of travel, but all other elements of COP as well. And of course, quite rightly, there will be scrutiny. But we will make sure that this is as sustainable as possible and that people travel there in a low emission manner.
Well, thank you, Alok, and thank you, Jaina. Amber and John, I want to get to this point about that a big decision is going to be made in terms of moving us towards net zero. And presumably that is the starting gun being fired for a whole slew of agreements, regulations and policies that then have a direct impact on business. Amber, I know you've been putting some thought into this, and then John, I'll come to you.
Yes, I mean the difference was in Paris. It was just, can we get an agreement? Yes, we can. This one feels much more like what are the commitments that are going to come out of it that will make this happen faster? And I think that one of the issues that may come out of it is to do with carbon pricing and carbon, more about the polluter paying, more discussions about supply chains in the same way that the UK and the EU and the US, to some extent, have put various restrictions on supply chains in terms of modern slavery and other issues. I would expect more of that. So I think that businesses should be thinking about what those announcements might be and trying to get ahead of them now so that they're not just responding to them at the end of the year, in the same way that, as Alok described, when the internal combustion engine was effectively banned, has been effectively banned from 2030, most car manufacturers had already got their electric car plans in place. The time to start thinking about what those conclusions might be is now, so that businesses can start to adjust. Because the other point I would make is that whatever the announcements are that are agreed at the end of this year, it's only going in one direction over the next few years. This is, we talked in Paris about a ratchet mechanism. That's what's happening here. Technology is keeping up. People's efforts to apply themselves to address it are keeping up. The civil society commitment is keeping up, but it will only go in one direction after this year. The next COP that is significant, 2, 3, 4, 5 years time, will further reduce carbon emissions on all the different elements that we've been talking about, as John said, not just electricity, but on heavy industries and other issues. So smart businesses will be looking ahead now to make sure they get ready for that over the next 5, 10 years.
John, if you're a hydrocarbon heavy business, you've been thinking about this for a long time, but there's a lot of businesses that maybe don't see themselves as naturally fitting into the climate change net zero debate, who are going to be impacted by these kind of regulations that come in and laws and agreements. What would you say to businesses in terms of planning?
Yeah, so I think important, actually, that irrespective of the nature of business, that people just think very carefully about the impact they're having, because we all have an impact, however small or however large, and starting to think about the commitments that you can make as a business, whether it's the carbon reduction or whether it's signing up to the science-based targets or making broader commitments, not just for 2050, which is quite easy to do for a business because it's so far in advance, but actually making commitments for 2025 and 2030. And then working with your board to really identify what actions and investments you're going to take to be able to support those targets. I think that's what, you know, I'd encourage businesses to do. I think from a broader business perspective, you know, I'm hopeful that COP26 will have very clear roadmaps for each of the sectors, and then we align policy to those roadmaps. Because for business, a lot of the investment that we make is lumpy, and therefore having clarity on policy and regulation enables us to then invest on the back of that, knowing that we've got some stability going forward. So for me, there's what you can do internally, but there's some broader things to think about as well.
Okay, let's get some more questions from our audience now. Andy Briggs is the CEO of Phoenix Group. Andy's just coming into Vision now. Andy, I believe you've got a question for the panel.
Yes, thanks, Craig. Good afternoon, Amber Allop. Good to see you again, and nice to meet you, John. Interesting what you were just saying there, John. One thing we committed to at Phoenix Group is what we'll get all of our investments, the $300 billion a year we invest on behalf of our customers, to be net carbon neutral by 2050. We've actually committed that our own operations will become net carbon zero by 2025. So exactly as you said, we've got to set targets along the journey. But my question is, we are investing over £300 billion as the UK's largest long-term savings and retirement business on behalf of our customers. We're really keen to deploy that firepower to support the government's Build Back Better and Greener approach. Ourselves, we would love to invest about £20 billion over the next 5 years in new sustainable assets across the savings and retirement industry as a whole. That number is probably more like £100 billion. How can we as a sector best partner with government to bring this about?
Alok, do you want to take that? And then Amber, maybe a sentence from you?
Yeah, that'd be great. Andy, lovely to see you again. Look, I mean, I think you raise a really important point. I guess there are two sort of answers to this. One is the work that you are doing and others are doing in terms of committing to this the Race to Zero challenge. And John talked about the fact that, you know, it's easy to make a commitment to 2050. That's a long way away. But actually, it is the pathway to net zero by 2050, which is also vitally important. Just as it is for countries, it is also important for companies as well. And it is, of course, we ask asset owners to join campaigns like the Net Zero Asset Owners Alliance. There's trillions of dollars has already been committed in assets to that. But I think the issue of the folks that you then work with, effectively your supply chain, how you can support them as well in going to net zero, I think is vital. And then in terms of deploying your cash, as I said, you know, at the end of the day, this is a piece for government. We talked, by the way, about hydrogen earlier on in this discussion. The government's working on a hydrogen strategy, which I hope will come out this quarter. And the intention as part of that is also to show how can you actually set out these revenue mechanisms to allow the private sector to invest in clean technology. And it goes back to this point that I know all of us sort of share this view, is that if we want to get the private sector to invest, you have to be able to demonstrate that it is an investable project and there is going to be a return. So I think that the work we're doing on the hydrogen strategy, that actually involves the private sector as well as government, as well as academia. And I think it's an example of the support that we're getting from the business community in terms of coming up with these mechanisms which will allow them to invest and thereby ensuring that we have growth within renewables and in green tech.
Amber, this point about engaging with government, a lot of businesses find that very tricky. Just a sentence or two from you on it.
Well, I think we are experiencing it every moment that you chair this for us, Craig, with Andy asking his question to Alok. I mean, good policy backed up by legislation that is enduring and political consensus, which we have in the UK, will allow for successful investment in effectively regulated assets. So it's a great partnership between the public sector and the private sector. Offshore wind, we keep on referring to it, but it's a very good example of how successful that has been. And the bids for the licenses just 10 days ago show how competitive it's been becoming to participate when what is a reliable, good, secure, long-term income, albeit low, in this sector.
Okay, that's really helpful. I'm going to come to Brad Andrews now, who's the president of Worley. Brad, let's just get you up in vision. And if you want to put your question, that would be great.
Thanks, Craig, and thanks to Alok and John and Amber for today's remarks. You know, at Worley, we're a leading global engineering firm that supports companies in the energy, resources, and chemical space. We're engaged here in the UK across a number of carbon capture, offshore wind, hydrogen, both blue and green, and waste of fuels projects. And through our large UK workforce, we're able and are responsible for delivering and operating a lot of these projects over the next coming years. We will be at COP26 with our partners and our clients to showcase a number of these projects. So I'd be interested to know, what are the most important elements that the UK government would like businesses like ourselves to highlight at the event in November?
Yeah, look, I think that's naturally one for you. Thanks, Brad.
Yeah, thanks for that, Brad. Look, I think it's great that you and your partners and clients are going to be at COP26. Obviously, you know, we have the official part of the summit with the Green Zone, the Blue Zone, etc. But I know already that there are a lot of external parties who are taking up space in Glasgow so that they can display the work that they are doing in terms of tackling climate change. I very much take the view that let a thousand flowers bloom, so to speak. And we want to encourage as many corporates technology companies and universities to actually showcase what they're doing. In terms of the areas that we have been sort of focused on from a COP26 perspective, we've got five campaigns that we are running to do with clean energy or energy transition, if I can put it like that, clean transport, nature-based solutions to effectively heal the planet, the work that's going on in adaptation resilience, and of course finance. So I think it would be great to see some elements of how within those areas change is being made by corporates and others so that we are seeing the energy transition, we are seeing clean vehicles on our roads. And as well as obviously displaying in space, corporate space that you may already have got, there is of course also an offer that we have made to civil society as well as corporates to come and display in the Green Zone at the summit itself. And there's an expression of interest that is open until the 8th of March. We're not going to be obviously looking to sort of charge people to display there, but what we're looking for is collaboration. So where there's an opportunity for a corporate to have linked with a civil society group or indeed a university to show what together they are doing in terms of tackling climate change. So, brilliant that you're coming. Please encourage others to come up as well. And like I say, if you haven't already done so, have a look at the expression of interest, and we'd love to hear from you.
That's really interesting, Alec, and that date is certainly a big motivation, I think, for a lot of people to move. John, I just want to come to you because being a sort of a tier one sponsor of COP, you've had to sign up to a lot of these things. I mean, the good thing about it is that they're actually quite painful, some of the things that you actually have to sign up to as a business. What would you say to businesses who are saying, you know, look, this is going to be tough for us? We've got it, for example, on the race to zero, we have a credible plan within 2 years, that kind of thing. What would you say to those businesses who are saying, well, maybe the bar is just a little too high at the moment?
I'd sort of come back to what Amber said earlier on, which is, you know, our stakeholders, our investors, our customers are expecting this of us, and the agenda is moving massively. I quite often tell the story, I've been CEO for 5 years, and 5 years ago when I talked to investors, to be honest, it was questions around what I was doing around climate change and the environment was sort of the thing they asked me as I sort of grabbed my briefcase and left the room. It is now the foremost thing on the agenda. So it is tough to sit down and really work through what you need to do, but it is absolutely a must anyway. So you might as well make the investment and do it as part of COP26, because there is a fantastic opportunity, I think, to showcase the UK and some of the massive engineering, some of the great technologies we've got. So I would just encourage people to get on with it, to be honest, because it'll get you ahead of your stakeholders if they're not there already.
Brad, was that useful for you?
Yeah, very much so. It's really important that all facets of the ecosystem come together in concert, I think, and actually agenda forward. So thank you.
Thanks, Brad. I'm just looking at some of the comments and things that are coming in. And a theme that's coming up is going back to my initial question, which is so Nick Lakin from Kingfisher is saying, building on Craig's first question, the problem is the cost of to households. An electric car is comically expensive. A hydrogen boiler or ground source heat pump is plus £10,000 per household. The government has just pulled its Green Homes grant funding. Where's the money to fund the rhetoric? Let's go to you, Alec, on that, and then Amber, maybe, to, you know, people are feeling the pain financially.
So I think, I mean, let's talk about electric vehicles since we've been on that particular theme. So you can buy an electric vehicle for, I think, around £29,000. So it's a £3,000 grant that you can get towards that from government. And of course, that was topped up as part of the 10-point plan. The issue, of course, it also is that you need to look at the life cycle of running a vehicle. So clearly, it's significantly cheaper. So I'm stating the obvious here, but it's significantly cheaper to run an electric vehicle than it is a petrol or diesel vehicle. But the issue here, I think, Craig, is that, and you're absolutely right, is that for a lot of people, £29,000 is a lot of money to pay for a car. On the other hand, the work that is going on now by the manufacturers, but also the support that the government is providing, will, I hope, mean that we are going to see production of EVs go up. You will see economies of scale mean that prices do come down. You will see more charging stations, and therefore that sort of range anxiety issue that some people have about whether they should or shouldn't buy an electric vehicle hopefully dissipates as well. So I think, you know, in the same way, I mean, we talked about offshore wind, the speed and pace at which that has grown. I mean, John talked about coal. You know, less than a decade ago, I think in 2012, 40% of the power in the UK was coming from coal. It's now less than 2%. So things can actually technologically move very fast as well. But you're right. I mean, there has to be an incentive for people to take those on. And as I said, there is a £3,000 grant that is currently available, and I hope that over the coming months and years we will see a big uptake in electric vehicles, because actually that's what we're going to need as part of getting to that net zero by 2050.
Okay. I'm going to bring Nicola Green in here, who's the Director of Corporate Affairs at O2. She's just popped up in Vision. Actually, this is a question. It's being reflected quite a lot in some of the comments that are coming through, so it's very apposite. So Nicola, would you want to put your question?
Certainly, thank you. So we at O2 have set an ambitious target to be the first UK mobile network to reach net zero carbon by 2025. But one thing that really kind of interests us is, how does government plan to facilitate business engagement to develop and sustain the legacy of COP26, both in the UK and also around the world?
So, Alec, do you want to take that
one? Absolutely. So look, I think you're right. I mean, legacy is going to be a big issue as part of all of this. I mean, there's a lot, obviously, as we've discussed, that business is already doing. You're signing up to the Race to Zero. You're signing up to initiatives like RE100 and EE100. All of that is ongoing, so that's great. One of the things that we have got is a campaign called Together for Our Planet, and we are doing more work on this. And I hope, and this is, by the way, how do we engage not just business, but the whole of civil society in terms of COP26? So I'm very clear that what I do not want COP26 to be is an event where people see a whole bunch of world leaders fly in, a whole bunch of world leaders fly back out. That is absolutely not what I want to see COP26 being represented of. We want to get the whole country excited as part of that. So we are working out this campaign on called Together for Our Planet. We've already launched some of the initiatives around that in relation to schools to get younger people involved in all of this. And as part of that, we're of course looking to see what sort of legacy could come out of COP26 in the same way that you've seen legacy come out of other big events that the UK has organised. And by the way, I mean, I think it's true to say that this is probably the biggest event of its kind that the UK will ever have organised. So one is that we are delivering success at COP26 when it comes to tackling climate change. The other is infusing the public, not just in our country, but actually around the world, to recognise this as the most important thing right now that we need to tackle for our generation and, of course, future generations as well.
That's John,
just a quick one to follow up on that for Nicola. John, presumably a lot of what you're doing is, as a tier one sponsor, is having to partner with other businesses and that kind of thing and work out how you move things forward. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that's exactly right, Craig. We're, to Alec's point, we don't see COP26 being a couple of weeks in November. We see it as being an opportunity to build partnerships and collaboration to deliver net zero, both for us as a company, but more broadly in an enabling the UK. We are reaching out to different technology partners. I know Andrew Griffiths is on the line. We're looking at startup companies that we're partnering with in the US that we want to bring to COP26 to showcase some of the technologies that we think will be the future to help us with net zero. We're also linking up with communities and schools and with opportunities to really inspire younger people so they really connect with COP26. So there's a whole host of partnerships that we're developing, technology within the industry, within local communities, with schools and colleges, so that actually we build relationships that go way beyond the sort of the weeks of November.
Well, thanks on that, John, and thanks, Nicola. Alec, your old colleague, Sam Giemer, an old colleague of Amber and mine too, and a friend who's now at Goldman Sachs, is Sam Giemer. He's asking a question here, which is, financial services is a big enabler of change. What role does the government have in getting finance to play in catalyzing transformational change in the economy? Alec, do you want to go first? And then Amber, you can maybe...
A great question. And perhaps I can sort of digress a little bit, give me a little bit of latitude here, Craig, which is that at the start of last year, we launched the COP26 finance campaign. And this was at the Guildhall. And, I spent 20 years in finance before I came into politics. Amber, I know, has done the same. And I think it's fair to say that when she and I were starting our finance careers in the city, if someone had said, why don't we get together and talk about climate change, and not that many people would have been excited or turned up. This place was totally packed. I mean, literally standing room only. It demonstrated to me that, again, the financial service sector does get this. So you will have seen the commitments that have been made by asset managers in terms of investing in products which are, or in companies that are committing to net zero. We've also got TCFD disclosures where people are able to sign up to those You'll have seen that Rishi has now said that by 2025, this is something that's going to be mandatory in the UK. But again, you know, I just make this point that I think the financial services sector, along with lots of other sectors of business, are already getting ahead on this journey. So in a way, I don't think we even really need to tell them. They understand this. And going back to this point about shareholder value, if you look at the market caps of what I would call green economy companies and compare them to sort of, how should I describe this, more traditional economy companies, you see the divergence, right? You see the divergence. And I would argue that actually going green is the biggest investment opportunity that there is right now if you're an investor or indeed if you're a corporate.
That's great. Listen, I've got an eye on the clock, so I'm going to cut you off on this one, Amber, and not come to you on that. But I am going to come to you on the sort of summing up question that I want to ask you all. That on the one hand, you look at this and it's like one of the biggest challenges mankind has ever faced. There's nothing on this scale and the devil is in the detail and it's extraordinary. And yet you're all optimistic. I just want to give you 30 seconds each to say, try and galvanize the people on this call and business of why they should get behind COP and get towards a credible net zero plan going forward. So big question, you've got 30 seconds. Amber, you go first.
This is only going in one direction. It may happen at different speeds, but it's very clear that the world wants everybody to decarbonize. And I think everybody needs to participate in that. Clever financing models and low cost of money will be part of the answer to that, enabling it. And finally, could I just say that the question from Kingfisher was extremely good. We don't have the answers on that. Government has committed to decarbonising effectively 600,000 houses through addressing the carbon on heat, but we don't know how yet. So I think we should circle back on that one.
John.
Being succinct, I'd say three reasons. You know, from a business perspective, why you should get behind it. One is your investors are going to expect it. So you need to get ahead of it. So I think it's fundamentally you do that. Second, your customers are going to expect it. So I do think as we move forward and as we engage more broadly with society, that people are going to look to companies that are actually committed to the agenda and are seen to be supportive of it. And then finally, a very practical one for all people who run businesses. It is so helpful for attracting and retaining and motivating talent. And whatever business you're in, if you want to be successful, then you need fantastic human capital. And this is a differentiator for those companies that can really be committed.
And Alok, a final word from you.
So Craig, brilliant answers from Amber and John there. But I think there is one single reason that, a very human reason why we should be doing this. And that is safeguarding the future of future generations, your kids, your grandkids, your nieces, your nephews, that is who you're doing this for ultimately. So please let's work together and let's deliver success at COP26 in Glasgow in November. And look forward to seeing you all there.
We're looking forward to it too. I always say at the end of these calls, thank you to the panel. I think it's been an exceptional panel this week. Thank you to Alok for giving up his time and for John and for Amber, all of whom are very busy. They've all gone and answered the difficult questions, have been inspirational on it too. So I know that everybody is basically giving their usual virtual standing ovation and round of applause now, even though we can't hear it. But thank you so much, that was brilliant. We'll be following up with some notes and hopefully we'll be able to get you all together in a few months' time to see how the progress is going. But in the meantime, thank you very much. I thought that was absolutely fascinating. Thank you.